you again. You're getting me here and keeping me here and making me work without
local
fear.
Voices and
love and kindness.
This is CQW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Generous support to CKUW 95.9 FM is provided by Diversity Food Services. Diversity is a social enterprise committed to a just and fair food economy in Winnipeg. Spruce Catering is part of the Diversity Food Services family, a chef-driven, full-service catering company. The team brings together culinary talent for some of Canada's most prestigious food events. Please email hello@sprucecatering.com to get your event taken care of.
CKUW 95.9 FM for dialogue, Gravel Roads to City Lights, every second Friday at 8 a.m. I'm your co-host, Kaylin Spain, and we facilitate conversations bridging rural and urban Manitoba on hot topics.
And I'm Marianne Sorelli, the other co-host. Our initial idea was to facilitate dialogue on the radio between people who disagree, to model having a civil conversation about a difficult topic. The reality is, people don't want to come on the radio and disagree, but we're working on it.
In the meantime, we have interesting guests with interesting things to say on issues important to you as Manitobans. You belong. Good morning, CKUW listeners. You are listening to Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights. It's 8:05 about, roughly. We're here in the space together with some really amazing guests. Really, really excited. I'm the co-host, Kaylin Spain, and on air is my co-host, Marianne Sarielli. And we are here to talk about food prices, just this big, big, big topic that affects everyone. We all need to eat 3 times a day, sometimes more. Maybe you have 5 meals. I don't know what your situation is like, but we are here with some really incredible minds that have, we're going to dig into, issues around food prices, around what are farmers actually getting out of that consumer dollar. Excited for the show, Marianne.
Hi, Kaylin. Yeah, this is part of our MayWorks series, MayWorks Festival of Labor and the Arts, where we're talking with people concerned about workers' rights. And like you said, everyone has to eat. And this is a huge issue right now with the runaway inflation that we're experiencing. So we're going to be digging into this issue that's on everyone's mind these days about the rising cost of living and inflation driven by really record profits and many other factors now, including these wars, oil wars. And since the invasion of Iran, the U.S. and Israel are escalating the situation that's caused all this insecurity for oil shipments, driving up the price of oil, which affects the price pretty much of everything because we do have this oil-reliant economy. So which is affecting the price of fertilizers for food and many other things. So that's what we're going to be talking about for the next little while so our listeners can really get some new information maybe that they aren't getting from the mainstream media.
Yeah, really excited to have our guests here that are kind of, in some ways coming a little bit from both sides. So what we wanted to do was bring together some voices here from rural space. So looking at, how food prices, how the price of everything is affecting farmers. And then also look a little bit at how food prices are impacting you or the average eater, I guess. And so we really wanted to kind of bring these urban and rural voices together today. So I'll introduce our guests and welcome them to the show. We first have Bea Brusk, who is the president of the Canadian Labour Congress and former member of UFCW Local 832. Did I get that right? Secretary Treasurer. And so Bea has this incredible journey as well. You came to Canada, Bea, from Germany when you were 14 years old, and you worked your way up. You were a grocery clerk at 16 years old, and then the head of an organized labor in Canada. So welcome to the show, Bea. Really good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. And this is such an important topic. I'm so happy to be able to be part of it. Thank you.
Yes. And is there anything that you wanted to add to your bio that you want our listeners to know about you?
Sure. I mean, I come from a grocery retail environment. That's how I started in the labor movement as a grocery store worker and spent many years representing grocery workers, filing grievances, defending their rights at bargaining tables and bargaining for a fair deal for grocery workers, including organizing grocery workers. And so I do think that there's some unique insights that I can bring to this discussion because grocery workers certainly are struggling with the same affordability issues that so many other workers across the country are dealing with right now.
Okay, well, we're going to get into that, and thanks for adding that. We also have Fred Tate with us, who is a member of the Manitoba Agriculture Hall of Fame. So Fred's been farming your entire life, and had the pleasure of meeting you in person, Fred, at National Farmers Union events this winter. So you're 83 years old, Fred. We're going to put that out on the air.
And you're still advocating for many, many years later, advocating on behalf of farmers and for sustainable agriculture. So Fred, you're from Rosendale, Manitoba. Is that right?
That's true. That's true. And I've graduated into one more year, too, since you last recorded that. I'm in my 84th year now.
Okay. Well, congrats. And yeah, good to have you here. And it's nice that you also drove into Winnipeg. Thank you for you making the drive to be here on the show. And you also, like, you recently spoke at this CCPA Black Labor Studies Brunch. So you accepted an award on behalf of NFU and made a really amazing speech about, you know, the decline in income for farmers. And so I think we're going to get into that with you a little bit today.
Yes. Yes, it's been a trend for the last 45, 55 years that the more we produce, the poorer we have become as a community, both socially, economically, and environmentally.
And we'll talk about that more with you as to how that's impacting kind of the average farmer who is working to provide food for people, but what that means for their incomes as well. So we'll talk about that more. Thank you so much, Fred. Welcome here. And we also have James Hannay, who is a policy analyst with National Farmers Union. So bringing some of that policy perspective here with us today. So welcome, James, to the show.
Thanks, Kaylin.
Yeah, good to have you here. So, all right, let's get into this. I think we first want to start maybe with you, B. If you can tell us a little bit more about kind of your involvement, with the, just from your perspective, like, what are you seeing right now are some of like the biggest kind of issues in terms of supply chain issues? What are you seeing? Let's start maybe there.
But what we're seeing across the country is that workers across the country are dealing with an affordability crisis. Grocery costs have increased exponentially, right? Prior to the pandemic to now, it's gone up substantially. So we had food inflation running at about 3% a year, and now we're closer to 4% a year. From the end of 2021 to now, the cost of actual groceries has gone up by about 30%, which is really not tenable. It is not sustainable for the average family to continue to buying their groceries. We see food bank usage at an all-time high. We hit the highest food bank usage of all time in Canada last fall with 2.2 million users across the country. And a fifth of those users are workers, are employed, full-time employed, but don't have the capacity to be able to put food on their own table. And part of that is the rising cost of absolutely everything, rent, transportation, all of those things. But it's also what actual food is costing in the grocery store. So we're in a very dire situation right now. I can tell you it's not because grocery store workers or food production workers or farmers are getting more money in their paychecks. It's because there's excessive corporate profits that is driving this challenge that we are all having to navigate. And so I think this discussion today is really important to actually unpacking that, to see what we can collectively do to navigate that situation.
Yeah, well, as a farmer myself, I would say, but also just as a consumer, like, I'm kind of wondering, well, who is getting the, if food prices are going up, who's kind of getting this money, right? And so I think we need to kind of talk about that a little bit today and get into that. Fred, can I bring you in here? What has been like your experience when you look at like supply chain and what has it been like for farmers when you kind of look at the work that you've been doing with the National Farmers Union?
I guess I probably couldn't have predicted the negative outcome that we've reached. We were promised that if we increased our productivity, if we adopted the latest of technologies, that we could feed a starving world and our rural communities would thrive. The very opposite has happened. The rural communities are in a state of decay, and we've created a food system that is creating great economic harm in the rural communities, and it's creating great economic harm now in the urban communities. There are some tremendous costs to creating a food system that disregards the value of rural communities and local knowledge. And it also, when it impoverishes people, there is a social cost and there's an economic cost there, because people that are impoverished and can't achieve, acquire an adequate diet, those costs show up someplace else in society. And I'm still optimistic after seeing all of this that we can change this around. If there's anybody that wants to argue with me that the marketplace, uncontrolled, using its own values, can create a food system that will serve the needs of society, I would welcome the opportunity to debate them on that point.
Maybe a show next year, Marianne, we could get someone.
I was just going to say, we're going to dialoguing,
right? We were trying to move in this show from debate to dialogue, and maybe we could get someone on the show, Fred, with you, and see if they could meet the feet. James, do you have anything to add to that as to what Fred was saying about?
I think Fred is right on the money, both literally and figuratively. I think one of the greatest things our report showed that we'll be talking about more later, it really unites what B and Fred have been saying, is that, you know, there is a common enemy between consumers and farmers, and it's really about building that power between those two groups and finding the unifying issue, which I hope is this issue, to create change.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting what you said about unifying farmers and consumers a little bit. So almost like that they have this similar, they're looking at this and they can see a kind of a common enemy, if you will. Like, B, do you want
and
to
And I would just here? Add, well, I was yeah. just going to add, it's not just farmers and consumers, it's all the workers, the 3 million workers that the Canadian Labour Congress represents that we're talking about. So the people that are working in grocery stores, that are working in all the other places of the supply chain, whether they're driving trucks or you know, all the other areas that are involved in the food system, is to take that full supply chain view and to really figure out where the pressure points are and what's different. So we can come back to some of the things that Fred said too, but I just wanted to make that point that it's what we're doing here today is talking about farmers, workers, and eaters, all of us that eat.
Yeah.
Well, and you make a good point. I mean, farmers and workers, we all need to eat. We all visit a grocery store at least once every week or so, right? Some of us more than once a week. And so that pain that people are paying at that cash register is something that's universal to everyone that lives in Canada. It doesn't matter where you live. And certainly in rural areas in the north, where transportation costs are exceptionally higher as well, again, it creates another barrier to good, nutritious meals, which is the other reality, right? And so that is a problem. But I would tell you that you know, I can point a finger at the culprit in terms of this particular issue very easily. I think we all can. It's corporate profiteering is what's at stake here. We know that prior to the pandemic, the three big grocers in this country, Loblaw, Sobeys, Metro, they collectively have 2/3 of the grocery market in Canada across the country. Their average profits in 2019 prior to the pandemic was 2.4 billion, and as of 2022 that jumped up to 3.6 billion. Like, that is a significant jump just in a couple of years. Now, granted, during the pandemic people stayed at home, you bought more food at the grocery stores instead of going out to eat, you know, all those kinds of things, but the actual sales amounts since then haven't actually increased in terms of more, you know, cartons of milk being bought. It's the profit margins that have increased that have actually caused them to have a much higher profit margin than what they have had over the last number of years. And I can tell you, workers haven't seen a comparative increase in their pay packet at all. And I also just want to point out that most retail workers in Canada, whether it's for the big three, and I don't want to leave Walmart off this list or Amazon or Costco, because they are just as guilty. People buy lots of groceries in those three locations as well. Huge American chains, right? Also making gigantic profits on the backs of grocery consumers. You know, those workers are non-unionized at Walmart, Amazon, and Costco for the most part, right? What we're seeing, at least in the Loblaw, Sobeys, Metro, there are most of those workers are organized. They have the ability to negotiate a collective agreement. They have some benefits. They have wage increases. But these companies don't come to the bargaining table ever to say, hey, we made more than we anticipated last year, so let's be generous at the bargaining table. That right. never happens, my friends.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's very sad. Fred, did you want to jump in and respond?
Yeah, the whole argument going back some time, originally we were told, oh, well, we have to adopt all these new technologies in agriculture because we have to feed a starving world. Well, these new adoptions of these new systems, they didn't actually alleviate poverty or hunger at all, did they? In fact, they've made the situation much worse. And if you also look at the other part of the theory that they said, well, of course, if we had larger, more efficient corporations, then they would be able to operate so efficiently, we would be able to reduce the cost of food to consumers. And what we've seen they've done, they've had exactly the opposite. They've reduced the income of farmers, and they've reduced the ability of the lower classes to even access that food. There isn't any credibility left in this system, except in some people's imagination. And it's a daunting task to make this the public issue that it needs to be before it's going to change, because the damage that has been done, we're jeopardizing the food production system itself. And unfortunately, as people become stressed under this system, they tend not to look as toward the source of the stress. They tend to look for scapegoats. I've heard people blame it, of course, on the carbon tax, on Aboriginal people, on unions, mm-hmm. on immigrants, and on which way the wind is blowing, I think, some days. But it's a daunting task to say, well, just look here, follow the money, and you'll probably come to an answer as to why this is working the way it's working, and who it's working for, and who it's working against.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my in-laws had turkey quota for many years. They were turkey farmers here up in the Interlake north of Winnipeg, yeah. and they finally ended up selling their turkey quota, but it was like because the profits were you know moving towards a larger company essentially, so it was a cooperative, mm-hmm. and then it was essentially yeah. moving towards right, so everything is becoming bigger and bigger and bigger in agriculture. So you know they were the smallest turkey producer in Manitoba, and they had pasture turkeys, they were turkeys outside and trying to do mm-hmm. things a little bit more, you know, but just like they're getting squeezed, mm-hmm. like it's just yeah.
The thing is, it to be bigger as a farmer means that you work on a smaller margin. To become bigger as a food retailer or food processor, you work on a larger margin. The rules are exactly the opposite.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's that distribution of the wealth within the system. I've never known agriculture to be more productive than it is today. And I've never known in my life for agriculture to be as economically insecure as it is today. And the same thing I can say for consumers. Consumers have never, since probably the Great Depression, faced such insecurity in food and in housing and their economic stability as they are today. And they, as I said earlier, they're looking in the wrong direction for solutions.
Well, let's talk about this new report that the National Farmers Union has done, James. Fair food prices, the declining farmer share in food inflation. Maybe you could just give us a little bit of a summary on that report, and then we can talk a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. The Fair Food Prices report was a follow-up to some work that we did as the National Farmers Union in submission to the House of Commons Food and Agriculture Committee when they were doing their study on food price inflation in 2023. Mm-hmm. And what we were hearing a lot at that time was, especially from large retail grocers who were facing a lot of heat, was that they had to increase their prices because of, you know, supply chain disruptions and increased input prices. And they even named farmers passing along increased input prices as one of the reasons for why they had to also increase their prices. Mm. And from mm. what you know, Fred has been saying we have this data, especially at the NFU. We love our net farm income data and that graph that we always use. We know that farm net income hasn't seen any substantial increases in the last 30 or 40 years. In fact, it's been stagnant or negative at some points. So we know that farmers have not been able to pass their costs on to processors or grain elevators, etc. I mean, they can't. They face such a concentrated industry wherever they go in processing whatever product they're producing, same as consumers are facing with grocery stores. But we wanted to expand the two or three products we used in that submission to the House of Commons to show that this is an issue across all products that farmers produce. Well, I shouldn't say all products necessarily, because we do point to supply management as one of the places where farmers mm-hmm. can get a stable return for their prices. And also notably, consumers are not experiencing as many frequent or sharp price movements. Like you're not seeing as big of a price increase in a short period of time on butter as you might in other grocery store products. Mm-hmm. So we do have policies in place for some farm products to protect consumers and farmers and ensure that there's a fair share going mm-hmm. to farmers for their labor and their inputs. But mm-hmm. that's not the case for everywhere. And we do point out... Go ahead. Sorry, Maria. No, that's okay.
Well, I was just going to jump in because I want to make sure our listeners understand what you're saying. And one of the things that the report shows is when we use a term like supply management, I'm not sure that CKUW listeners in Winnipeg know what that means. We lost the Canadian Wheat Board, but there are certain commodities and farm products that farmers produce that are still having single desk marketing. So I wonder if you could just explain that a little bit more so that people understand that certain things have not seen the kind of inflation because there is supply management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, supply management is, well, it's not an easy thing to explain in a few sentences to people who are not necessarily immersed in the farm world. It took me a little while myself, not coming from a farm background, to figure out how exactly it works. But for supply management, it governs four product areas. It's poultry, so chicken and turkey, table eggs, and dairy. And essentially what supply management does is it ensures a predictable and fair return for farmers producing those products by calculating cost of production pricing, which means that farmers are getting paid for what it takes to produce mm-hmm. those goods and mm-hmm. to pay them properly for their labor. There's also the quota system, which ensures that we're producing exactly what the mm-hmm. Canadian population needs and mm-hmm. no more and no less, which ensures a stable supply and we don't see, you know, gluts in the market leading to extremely low prices or extremely high prices. And I think a good example of this would be in the United States. You see egg prices skyrocketing last year because of avian influenza outbreak, and our supply mm-hmm. management system sort of tempers that mm-hmm. those sorts of price movements. And then, of course, we have import controls, which means we have a Canadian market that's serving Canadians and is not taking lower priced, potentially mm-hmm. worse quality, you know, milk and eggs and chicken and turkey from other countries. We're producing exactly what Canadians need at prices that work for Canadians and Canadian farmers in Canada.
That's a really important thing for people to understand, is supply management has benefits to addressing inflation. Yeah. So Fred, go ahead and add to this.
No, supply management is, it's a contract that the suppliers of, or the producers of those commodities have with society. And they say, we will provide you this product at its cost of production, nothing more, nothing less. We will not be continually knocking on the door for assistance programs and so on to bail us out of crises. You shall not see shortages and you shall not see surpluses. You shall have a Canadian farmer supplying the Canadian consumer of a high quality product at the cost of production. And there's the system works. The system works so well that it's constantly under attack by people that could profit very handsomely if that system wasn't there.
Thanks, Fred. I want to bring Bea in here now. I can see you nodding, Bea, as you're listening. And I want to give you a chance to respond to what we're talking about here in terms of this report.
Sure, because what immediately comes to my mind is the current CUSMA renewal and the issue of dairy in Canada and the supply management that we have and Trump's focus on trying to get into the dairy game to be able to, you know, export their products into Canada and what that would mean for our economy, right? Like, these are things that are on every level we need to be aware of, and on every level we need to be guarding against glutting our market with cheap, lesser product, as James pointed out, that would drive the price down and cost farmers even more in terms of trying to keep up to that kind of product.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Fred.
And there's another thing that supply management does. It prevents the concentration of production into larger units, because the larger the unit of production, the greater the likelihood that nature will intervene with its pathogens and viruses and disrupt the whole system. We saw that happen in the United States with the egg production and poultry production. As we speak now, there's a dairy coming together in North Dakota that will have 27,000 cows in one facility.
Wow, that's sad.
All that is a road to disaster. First of all, you have to dispose of the byproduct of that many cattle, which is the manure, which you can't do economically because of the loss. So you have to be amend the environmental rules to accommodate it, is usually what happens. But nature will interfere with that one. When you diversify your dairy and your poultry the way we have in Canada, nature from time to time will intervene, but it'll be very small. It'll be very small, and there won't be the catastrophic changes that we see in the United States, where when eggs got to be $2 a piece. We've avoided all that. Our system we have in place gives us that protection, and it gives economic security into the agriculture communities that none of the other commodities can provide.
You know, what we're talking about here, I just want to make sure that people understand CUSMA is the new free trade agreement. So, you know, we are trying to help people who are consumers to have a little bit more information about what is driving the cost of food. So that's what I want to talk about next is, maybe we'll start with you, Bea, this time, is talk a little bit. You've already described, you know, the situation with profits and the huge increase in the profits that those big grocery chains are making. But there are a number of other things going on. And I'm wondering from your perspective how you see some of the other drivers of the inflation that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, retail workers understand that they are the last cog in the wheel in terms of getting the product from the fields to, you know, the grocery bags that are going out the door. There's so many workers in between and so many levels that have to be taken into consideration. We've got food inspectors, we've got transportation issues, we've got the veterinarians, we've got, you know, salespeople, packaging, tradespeople working in the manufacturing facilities, all of those workers along that chain to actually get that grain or that, you know, piglet to the final end product in the grocery stores. And what's driving a lot of the cost increases isn't just the corporate greed. We certainly have seen that, and I've given you the numbers on that. Mm-hmm. But we also see the reality of increased input. So when we're looking at now the cost of gas and the cost of transportation increasing exponentially, that is a huge problem, right? That is going to be creating a problem all the way along that supply chain. We see the challenge with workers not being able to actually keep up with the rising cost of living when wages have only been going up less than what the cost of inflation in terms of the food inflation has been, right? Food inflation over the last three couple of years, 30%. Average wages increase in that same time period about 20%. So it is really, really a problem. But I continuously go back to the fact that we have giant corporations making more money than they ever have before, and workers along that supply chain not getting a fair deal. And I'll just give you an example. We have our federal government, you know, laying off thousands of public service workers, right? And we may not think necessarily that much about public service workers here in Manitoba because we think they all work in Ottawa. Well, they don't. You know, those food inspectors that are making sure that the food is safe for you to eat, they operate all across Canada. They need to have a fair wage so that they can actually put food on their table. They're being denied that in many ways, right? We're looking at the tradespeople who, you know, go to school for many years to learn their trade, to be able to navigate the workforce and what they need to do, that are employed in different manufacturing facilities. They need to have good, safe working environments with a fair wage that's going to recruit and retain those folks in smaller communities in particular, right? You know, where some of the manufacturing facilities are located, which is often a challenge for us. You know, transportation workers, all kinds of challenges in our public transportation system and our long-haul trucking and rail kind of issues. You know, we've seen different levels of government deny workers the right to actually strike to get a fair deal, to be able to get a fair wage when they order folks like port workers to go back to work or rail workers to go back to work, undermining their ability to actually get a fair deal at the bargaining table. And so these are all things that drive the challenge between what's in your pocketbook and what you can spend at the grocery store.
Yeah, there's another side there that that is important too. That the production side now is becoming increasingly dependent upon temporary foreign workers to make this system work, and that the injustice that's being applied there. If we are short these people and we need them here to work, then they stay here as Canadians. This business of moving these people back and forth for the convenience of dollars is not on. Frankly, it's not on at all. And it's a disgraceful thing that's happening here. And all it's doing is adding to the impoverishment of rural communities, creating a food system that consumers can't afford, and applying those type of conditions on temporary foreign workers. There's just no justice to this at all.
I agree with you 100%.
Makes me emotional, as I say.
For sure. Listen, I've seen the reality of migrant workers that are brought to Canada for the growing season and for the harvesting season and sent back home. The reality in terms of the fact that our labor laws do not necessarily apply to these workers and the treatment that they receive is subpar. It is absolutely horrific. And those are workers that we absolutely take advantage of when it comes to picking our crops and getting the things on our tables. And most Canadians are not necessarily aware of what that actually looks like. There is a difference between that and the temporary foreign workers that are working for employers where they have a pathway to citizenship and a pathway to stay. And in my view, if you are good enough to come and work in Canada so that we have the foods that we need on our table, then you're good enough to stay here and you're good enough to be able to bring your family and make this your home and be an active part of our communities.
Amen to that.
Yeah, I just wanted to give James a chat because this whole issue of the wages of those foreign workers that are picking and harvesting food, and it's almost like it's, you know, modern day slavery, really.
Yeah.
But I want to bring in the point because when we're talking about drivers, I mean, the fact that they are paid low wages, that they are on these precarious work permits, isn't that also saving money? Because if they were paid what they should be paid, wouldn't that just add to the cost of food even more? So what we're getting at is what really is the cost of growing food that we need to be able to accommodate? So, and then I'm going to go to Kaylin with talking a little bit more some of the other drivers.
Well, I can even add to that, Marianne, that these people that come here from a lot of them from Central America come from very depressed communities, and they work hard and they send their money back to their communities, and that's drained out of our community. If they were citizens here, all their earnings would stay in our community, and it would have an economic impact, a positive economic impact. This should end. In fact, it never should have started, but it's entrenched now, and they say, well, we can't compete without it. Well, we better look at the distribution of wealth within the system. The wealth is in the system to allow us to pay labor and treat labor very well. The money is there. It's the distribution problem of that wealth that is the issue here. And there's a great avoidance. The talking heads that talk about agriculture, farmers union, they never seem to have made these connections yet. I don't know if there's a bit of intellectual impairment there, or perhaps there's a reluctance to jeopardize their comfortable positions by criticizing a system that often helps fund them along their comfortable ways in academia.
Yeah, go ahead, James. Thanks, Fred. Yeah.
I would agree with you, Fred. The question about, are we going to see higher grocery prices if we actually pay food system workers the wage that they deserve. There's a great report. I'm referencing a report that is not mine now, but there's a great report that was written by a student named Alex Purdy for the Broadbent Institute about grocery store concentration and food price inflation. And I just want to read this quote about inflation related to the sort of what we call the wage price spiral of, if we increase wages, grocery prices or prices in general are going to increase. He says, inflation is not a natural and predetermined phenomenon existing in an abstract vacuum and forced into life when workers try to better their conditions. It is a pricing strategy set by companies and one designed to increase profitability at the expense of labor and consumers. And I think that is the perfect way of describing how this works. And economic minds better than me have written about how inflation has been used as a tool in the past to keep wages and real wages low for many people who are not in the 1% or in the wealthy class.
Thank you, James. I want to bring you into this too. I'm wondering about also things like surveillance pricing and kind of like how that plays in. Like, I know you're somewhat familiar with that from your years with the UFCW, and so I'm just wondering if what you can kind of tell us about what is surveillance pricing, first of all. Like, is that
I just want to go back to what James had to say. I just want to remind us that when the 99% get a wage increase, we spent that wage increase. We put our kids in extra karate lessons, or we buy a new pair of shoes, or, we go to dinner or put something extra in our grocery basket. When the 1% gets an increase, they can only live in so many homes. Let's be honest here. So in order to actually grow our economy and have economic activity, the average person needs to get a better shake so that they actually have a little bit more money to spend on the things that they need. When it comes to issues like surveillance pricing, it's interesting how every single grocery store, the cost of a product will be within cents of one another, right? Like, it's not like one is going to be way up over here and one is going to be way down there. They all buy from the exact same suppliers. They all generally buy within that same band of their profitability, right? They all know what the cost is going to be at their competitors across the street, next week when that product is on sale and how much that competitor is making. We don't know that. We don't know when we buy that bag of pasta at the grocery store what the actual markup is on that, but every single employer can tell you what it likely will be. And so we are at a significant disadvantage as consumers when it comes to that particular reality.
No, you're exactly right, because in an economy, it's the issue of urgency of demand. People that are deprived in housing and food and clothing, if they earn extra income, that will go into the economy immediately. The people that have already met all their needs, their extra earnings will go into speculative purposes or perhaps foreign holidays. But let's take a look at an example of what's happened. And it was that report that really struck me. And that was the issue of bread pricing, where there was found by the Competition Bureau that there was price fixing done there. Okay. And there was a fee, an amount attached to it. But if you look at the graph after the decision that they had been found guilty of price fixing, the price of bread didn't come down at all. It stayed there. So they got to keep what they had put in initially, and they are still collecting those excess fees. Now, in a moment, I wouldn't be very compassionate with these people. I would have had probably the judge on a bench. They would have all been in prison. the people that were involved directly would have been in prison. I'd have considered that the extra earnings were a product of crime, and it would have been gathered back by and redistributed by government. And I would have broke up their corporations. And that would have put a lesson to the rest of the boys that are playing this game. We better not go there. We could get hurt. Because they got away with nothing except a little tarnish to a reputation. But those multi-million dollars that they collected in excess fees from poor families shopping for bread, I imagine, went a long way to cover off their temporary embarrassment by being caught in the, with their hand in the till.
Fred, the best I could do for you in that scenario is to offer you a $50 gift card to shop at my grocery store conglomerate. Does that make up for it?
Was it 50 or was it actually only 25, James? I can't remember.
It's probably 25.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Was it actually $50 or was it $25 that you got
probably
offered?
Probably closer to $25.
I just want to point out that when all these giant grocery stores have their point system and all of the information that they gather on you, they know exactly what you're buying week to week. They know exactly how to drive you to buy certain things, and they know exactly what they need to order more of and what they can actually ramp up the cost on based on your purchasing habits, right? So all of these. It's really a way to surveil, you know, the information about you and gather data points about you. So we should be really cognizant of that, that when we're shopping at these giant stores and we're busy trying to get those points to save some money, they're actually utilizing all of that personal information for their own gain.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think back to the J.P. Lavlin case. We had what they called a deferred prosecution. And in the bread price fixing, we had a deferred embarrassment delayed. That's all we got. I mean, it's an embarrassment to say you live in a country that allows that to happen.
I do want to offer some solutions, though. Like, I do think that there are some things that we should be looking at and pushing different levels of government to enact or to do. And one of the things that I was happy recently was seeing the provincial government talking about the property restrictions and lifting what that actually means in terms of a grocery store owning a location close to them but not wanting to sell it to another potential grocery store owner, right? We need more competition and actually in order to bring prices down. And when giant corporations get away with not selling a piece of land or having a store stay empty. And I'll just give you an example. In Steinbeck, there's a Safeway store that's been empty for, I think, 15 years now. There's a Sobeys store owned by the same corporation right across the street. Why is it that there isn't a new grocery store that's opened in that location? And there's lots of those kinds of locations all across this province that we can point to. This is a problem that levels of government need to address. I think we should be looking at things like a windfall tax. Like, how much profit is enough profit? Windfall taxes could actually be utilized to either force that employer to cap the amount of profit that they're making off their product to actually lower the prices or to increase wages and benefits for actual workers within that particular workplace. Mm-hmm. So a windfall tax is something that we should absolutely be considering. Things like price controls, there's no reason why we can't stabilize prices on basics across Canada and have price controls be actually put into place in terms of what you can charge for those basic things. And I will always argue that strengthening access to collective bargaining for workers is the best way to actually increase a paycheck and to get more balance in the system. And so making sure that we have good organizing legislation in all jurisdictions so that workers can organize, can form a union, and can bargain collectively for their rights.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that in a so-called free enterprise economy, we've set places that there can't be competition. And nobody.
We only want competition when it benefits us.
Nobody seems to notice the contradiction, except perhaps some people in the Farmers Union that are considered to be a bit eccentric. But
I wonder if James or Fred, like, what are some of the other solutions that you see, given the report that you did and some of the other things that we've been talking about? Go ahead, Fred.
Well, I don't know where to start with this, but my experience has been over a long period of time spent lobbying a minister of a government, both federal or provincial, is largely time wasted. Your best efforts are that if you can create smoke in the countryside And I don't care the color of the fire truck anymore that comes to put that fire out. My objective is to create a fire. And sometimes been successful on some smaller issues and sometimes not so successful. But that's the only way change comes about. Because if you're in a minister's office talking to him, you're totally wasting your time. Because he's going to keep you there as long as he can. He's going to give you some reassurances that he's going to take this under consideration. He might even have some staff follow you up. But that's not going to happen. It's when more than 10% of people in a democratic society start to react and start to become vocal and start to show up at different meetings and demonstration that then the pyramid starts to shift. And it's not easy to do, but there isn't any other way to do it that I found that works.
So you're not talking about stubble burning when you say start a fire. You're talking about, organizing people and public protest and people being informed.
Because if you could meet a consumer as they left a shopping mall and take their basket apart and show how much went to the farmer, how much went to the labor that supplied their services, that processed that food and ran the till, and how much of that basket went to people that are already wealthy and contributed nothing in labor or anything else, I think you'd get a reaction out of that consumer. Mm-hmm. And I think there'd be quite a bit of anger, actually. It's to break through that barrier. And when you look at the way media is structured and you see those full-page ads from food stores, editors will be a little bit timid. They'll be a bit timid. And so that makes it that much more difficult. But the medium we're even working in today is an avenue.
And, I think when you say start a fire, Fred, I do think about some of the work that's really being done, in smaller groups. There's a great quote about, never underestimate the power of just like a small group of people to really make good change. And I think, there's a lot of really amazing work being done in Manitoba. I sit on the board for Direct Farm Manitoba, and I know NFU has had, some of its own kind of small clusters of people that are really working to make really good change in Manitoba and to look at like prioritizing local food supply, really local food chains, right? And to kind of connect, build the bridges between eaters and farmers more directly, to get that food, directly into the pockets of farmers. And so, but it's tricky. Any other thoughts on solutions here? B, you brought it up some really great ideas on solutions. Or James, if you have any other thoughts.
No. Well, I thought the conclusion of the report itself, I thought there was a lot of thought went into that, and I read it again last night and again this morning, and the direction is there. It's to achieve that direction is a difficult part, and to move this, we're talking here today amongst the converted, and when I go into a rural coffee shop or I go some other place socially, it is hard to make a connection of people that have never been exposed to the thinking that's taken place here today and in that report, and people that themselves have been so occupied by who's going to get voted off the island next or something like that, and they have all their own, their own problems they're dealing with, and they're not putting any thought, and they certainly aren't going to be educated about this through the mainstream.
Yeah,
that's not going to happen.
Well, the time has gone by so quickly. We could talk about this for a lot longer, but I actually think this is part of the solution: having organized labor, farmers, and consumers start some kind of alliance. So, yes, the small local, food supply is very important, but I've got a whole list of other solutions that we didn't even have time to talk about. And we didn't have time to talk about, how much theft has increased in the grocery sector and how much money is being spent on security and police and how that's driving up all sorts of other challenges. But I just want to say to wrap up that one of the things that we often try to end off on is what we want rural people to understand from, you know, the urban perspective and the other way around, what we want the rural folks to understand as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if we can just give you a chance to do that, but I want to also just thank you, Bea, for joining us on behalf of the mm-hmm. Canadian Labour Congress, and thank you to James and mm-hmm. Fred for joining us on behalf of the National Farmers Union. And I'll give you each a chance to just, what's the last message that you want, Bea, rural Manitobans to know?
Listen, we're in this together. We all need to rise together. We need to come together. And that means having difficult conversations that we're not always going to agree on. But if we don't have conversations, if we're only worried about who's going to be voted off the island next, none of our problems are going to get solved. So let's actually dig in and have those difficult conversations.
And from the NFU, what do you really want urbanites to understand about growing food in Manitoba?
They have to become involved. Because as it is, the marketplace itself is determining what happens to your food system. That is not working. It never worked, and it's getting worse. And so the urban people now have to become involved in establishing agricultural policy in this country, whose purpose is not to add profits to those that already have so much, but to provide food for those that have so little.
Wow. Great way to end. Thank you so much. And thanks, Kaylin, for co-hosting with me. This has been Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights, here on CKUW 95.9 FM here in Winnipeg. But you can listen to us out in Manitoba in about a 100-kilometer radius as well. Look forward to talking with you next time.
From all your jolly fellows, how would you like to go and spend one winter in the woods of Canada, yo? We're going up to Canada, is what we young can say. And going up to Canada depends upon the pay. We'll pay your passage out, but you must sign the papers that you will stay the route. For if you should get homesick and stay back home we'll go, we will not pay your passage from Canada, I.O. Pleasant journey on the route we had to go, and landed in Trois-Rivières in Canada, I.O. Oh, then the Norquois agent, he came a-prowling round, and said, my jolly fellows, why don't you all lie down? Hearts were made of iron, our souls were cased with steel. The hardships of that winter could never make us yield. Our food the dogs would bark at, our beds were on the snow. We suffered worse than poison in Canada, I.O. Homeward we are bound, and in this cursed country we'll never more be found. Go back to your wives and sweethearts, tell others not to go to that godforsaken country called Canada, I.O.
And an angel of the Lord came unto me,
and the angel said unto me.
You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
The Meta World's Tupaluk Show is a two-hour spontaneously generated sound art program exploring media, culture and chants. Every Wednesday 2 to 4 p.m. on CKUW 959 FM.
Join us in celebrating the diversity and beauty of the North End at the 3rd Annual North End Neighbors Cultural Festival, Saturday, May the 30th, 12 to 4 p.m. at the Ukrainian Labor Temple, 591 Pritchard Avenue. The theme of the festival is sharing our cultures and building relationships, and the event will feature free food, entertainment, displays, and activities. All are welcome to attend.
Meanwhile, several dimensions away.
Have you sold more albums doing it your own way?
Excuse me. I don't know whether the aim is to sell more albums. It's to not allow somebody in an office someplace to abuse you or what your ideas are. You know, I got into this because I have something to say. I happen to like music very much, and I have curiosity about what sounds are, how they go together, and I want to do it my way, and I'll take the chance that somebody will hate it. I don't care. I don't do it so that people will like me. If what I do amuses you or entertains you, that's great. I'm happy for you. Well, basically, I want to